I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Linda. I'm an Al-Anon.
Sober through the grace of God in AA since the 10th of December, 1967. For that, I'm very grateful. It's really great to be here. We missed last year because of our 50th wedding anniversary, which was, it was very cool. And I'm noticing that I'm still nervous when Clancy's in the front row. When one of the big guys are in the house, and there aren't many big guys left. You could be the last of the big guys. I can't, well, Tom. And it's noticeable. And we're going to talk about family recovery. Before I get into it, I got about 5 or 10 minutes of qualification of what we're going to talk about. We've been blessed beyond count. So I'm not here talking about how well we've done our marriage. That's not the conversation. I'm going to talk about what we've done in our marriage, but I'm not here to congratulate myself or us. Most of my life would be described the fact that I've been born on third base and congratulating myself for hitting a triple. I grew up in a Catholic, no-divorce zone ghetto. The two of us have gone through grade school, high school, and university in that educational process, and when we came together, even though I was a flaming drunk, we had the same values and the same belief. I'm one of 7 kids. My parents had 21 grandchildren. Those 3 brothers had 48 grandchildren. And I think there's one divorce that I can quickly identify, 1 or 2 divorces in that group. I mean, you just, mostly because you had to go home and explain it to your parents. It's a ghetto. I live in the town I grew up in. I see guys that I went to grade school with. My 7 closest buddies in high school, 4 of us are in AA, 1's in Al-Anon, all of us are married 50 years. I mean, that's unheard of. I mean, but get a sense of living in that village. It's a good thing. It's a simpler, I think living in the Midwest is less demanding than it is living in the major capitals of the world, and that's good. I'm married to one of the easiest women to be married to on the planet. One of the reasons I'm married is going to someone else and explaining why I want out would be a tough conversation to have because almost no one would buy in. So all those things make it easier in a sense. And staying married for 50 years ain't easy. Being sober for 50 years ain't easy. We're really going to be talking about maintaining a lifetime relationship with someone. Maintaining a lifetime relationship with anything is not easy. Your city, your faith, your marriage, your recovery. How many people keep the same sponsor for 45 years or whatever the hell that is? I mean, it is, there are always, if you're going to be doing something for a significant period of time, go read Thomas Merton. Go read, anybody who was in a monastery for a period of time. You're going to have dark nights of the soul. You're going to be in the desert for some of that time. And you're going to have to re-energize relationships all along the way. And that's kind of what, our program has sourced that for us. We have 3 children. All 3 kids are in recovery. My wife is a carrier. kind of like Typhoid Mary or whatever the hell it was, She never got it, but everybody around her got it. Well, none of us were alcoholic when we met her, for Christ's sake. So it was, it is.
Better be careful. I have friends in the room.
For the first 7 years of our marriage, I got sober on our honeymoon. We honeymooned in Mexico. I dove off the cliffs in Mexico, lucky to be alive. I had a slip. I've been in AA for 3 months, came back, turned myself in, got sober. Same sponsor for 43 years. I was a pain in the neck, a poor husband, and a really unmanageable guy for the first 6 or 7 years of my sobriety. I was one of the world's worst workers. I was a gambler. I supported myself by a salary I didn't deserve, and I made $5,000 to $10,000 a year playing backgammon. I was unhelpful when we started to have kids. I was an unhelpful husband, especially I was just doing AA and gambling and a little, you know, and marriage to the best of my ability. I was so unbelievably self-centered without knowing it. In a 7.5 years of sobriety, both of us hit a wall. I mean, I think it's astounding that we hit the wall at about the same time. I got to a point in my sobriety where I could no longer BS myself as to the state of my life. I was dishonest. I was one of the world's worst workers. Everybody knows how to work. I did not. If I knew, I didn't do it. I did not. I was a lame husband and a lame father. Not the way I grew up. Not the way I was trained. And at 7 years, I had a second surrender. First time I surrendered, I stood naked in front of my alcoholism, and it changed me. The second time I surrendered, I stood naked in front of my life, and it altered me. And after that change, at about the same time my wife was having kind of a nervous breakdown being married to a horse's ass, it's not a joke. And after those changes for the two of us, we came together in a way that was really quite remarkable. I'll talk more about that in a minute. For the moment, I'll...
He always just sort of dumps. And you know, he knows where he's going, but... Oh, wow.
Want me to continue? No.
I don't know what I want right now. The first, when I alluded to it or spoke a little of it this morning, when I first came to Al-Anon, I blamed everything on him. And there was I guess he's opened the door to the fact that there was a lot to blame on him. I usually don't share that little aspect to it, but I still volunteered. I love him. I loved him. I volunteered, signed up for it. But I expected something different. I expected to have a partner that, and I had a partner. I just didn't have the way I thought it was going to be. And so what I had to do in this process was grow up and take responsibility for the fact that we had three children. When I was having my quote-unquote nervous breakdown, I guess it wasn't that, but it was close. We only had two kids. Who are 2 years apart.
We have three now?
We have three now, yes. I'll introduce you. I think we all experience, all of our stories are really very much the same. Maybe you're not as lucky that your husband or spouse or partner gets sober right away. That was very different for us because most people didn't have that experience. But we also had real craziness in our house. We had alcoholism. And I got sick in alcoholism without drinking. So, I mean, this disease is so powerful. And I didn't understand. And, of course, like I told you, I was only working steps that I liked, and I was, I was doing the best I could. I was working as a nurse. I had the two kids. I really felt like I was doing it alone. And I had a lot of self-pity. And you know what that does for us? Makes us crazy. And it doesn't serve us well. And so finally, when I realized how bad it was, where it was going, I embraced Al-Anon. I took it upon myself to say, you're going to fish or cut bait. And I decided to put that boat in the water and to start fishing and to start being a part of it and to stop blaming Bob. And I think what happened is when I started to become who I was, just beginning, just peeks at who I am, I think I wasn't as critical of him. And then when I wasn't as critical of him, he started to behave better. So I sort of I focused on me. The flashlight turned, where before it was always on him. And I think, you know, we have been so incredibly blessed. It's just, I don't even know how to describe our blessings. We have three kids that are, three men, who are, I'm not sure about Daniel, but two of them are definitely sober. Bill had 30 years last, or maybe it was 31? 31. He had 31 years in August. And Peter has 27. Daniel had 18, but he had a relapse about a year and a half ago. And I am staying out of that. I'm not asking. I'm watching. I'm not seeing anything. And I have a good eye. Believe me, I have a really good eye. But I don't see it. I see a kid who seems pretty okay. And my Al-Anon program tells me, I almost can't say it, but it's none of my business. But he's my kid. But it's none of your business. And he's a delightful person. And all three of them are. They're good men. The gratitude in just that statement is beyond measure. I can't even come close. I talk on occasion. I'm not a big speaker. But when I do, there's always someone in the audience who comes up and says that their son or daughter is out there. Or that they lost him. And we just, I don't know. It isn't anything we did. It's just the way it is, and we're so very lucky. And the kids like us. And we get along. And if it hadn't been for AA and Al-Anon, that would not have happened. It just, I don't think it would have happened. Because we needed the steps of the program to get to know us, to get to know our kids, and to treat them with the respect that every individual deserves. That's what I think Al-Anon does the most. It gives you the ability to respect people. And I don't mean to say I'm never critical. I am. I wish I weren't. But I catch myself, and then I try to undo it or make amends or say, I was wrong here. You know, I really was wrong, and I want to change that. So Al-Anon has given me who I am. But my life is so blessed and so full of gratitude. And, I mean, the chances that we'd be married is, well, first of all, people don't live always to have the marriage for 50 years. So we've been lucky for that aspect. We've been lucky the fact that not only are we married 50 years, but we really like each other. We really enjoy being married to each other. And I give it, besides to God, I give all the credit to the two programs that we're involved in. Because these programs teach you to take a look at yourself, not the other person. No blame, just look at yourself. What can I change? What can I amend? What do I need to alter? What do I need to add? Whatever. So, gratitude is such a big part of my life, and I don't know why we were so blessed, but I'm not going to forget it any day until I get really mad at them, and then I'll forget it. But I'll only forget it for a minute, and then I'll remember again. Go ahead.
Yeah, great partner in recovery. To have a partner when you're standing on the dining room table urinating in the mashed potatoes, and have a spouse that's willing to look at her part, it is extraordinary. So we have good examples of marriages around us, our parents. Due to my extraordinary self-centeredness and alcoholism, it wasn't that way starting out. When I had my second surrender, one of the things I did is I started dating my wife. So I'm going to talk about a few things that we put in our marriage that made a big difference. I started dating my wife. I dated my wife every Friday night for 35 years. She was irritated with me, thought I was too active in AA. I was always out trying to save the world. And in those days, if someone asked me to give a talk, I would have ridden a bicycle here to give the talk. I made a deal with her. I'll do one a month. And for 30-some years, I did one a month. I cheated a little bit.
Always cheated.
Yeah. So, but it, you know, someone would lean on you, you know. One time Clancy called me and said, what are you doing Saturday? I said, I don't know. He said, you're giving a talk, and where's Jim from? Joliet, Illinois.
Oh.
I walked into a room with 600 people who didn't know Clancy wasn't coming. Was not good. Took about 20 minutes just to get them to listen to me. But we got a point where we were, when we were going out, we were talking about kids and money, kids and bills, which is not how we fell in love. And we had to learn how to go shack up in Chicago for the weekend, to go to Mexico. And we had this, you know, and after I got my, what made the, one of the major changes in my life at 7.5, 8 years of sobriety was I found out I was swimming in fear. I was, the reason I was a lousy worker is I was just, you know, afraid of everything. I was afraid of being a husband. I was afraid of being a dad. I was afraid of work. I was afraid of success. I was afraid of failure. I couldn't get myself to make, I didn't even take the chance that I made a sales call on you and you grabbed me, you know, grabbed me by the throat and forced me to sell you something, because I never was there. I just lied, which was the biggest part of my, you know, the biggest falsehood when Linda said I was a phony. I'll tell you, the relief of getting all the way in Alcoholics Anonymous and getting rid of that was just extraordinary. Many years ago, I did some work in an organization called EST, Werner Earhart, and we were, you know, we'd fly out to San Francisco and do some of those workshops. And I'll always remember that Werner was talking about one day, most of us in relationships have kind of a contingent relationship. Yeah, she's all right, but if she were, I'm just not sure she's the one. If she was just, I don't know, a little prettier, if she was a little nicer, I mean, if she had money, and what he ended up saying at the, so it's always like we're gathering evidence and comparing it to our script or the model or whatever the hell it is. And he said, why don't you decide she's the one? Why don't you grant her being the one? Early on, once when we would get it sometimes into a pissing contest, she would raise, I don't even know, maybe I did talk about the divorce word. And somewhere along the line, I went to her and I said, we can't use that word anymore. It's, excuse me.
Well, I'll finish it then. He said, I was very angry with him, and I don't remember about what, but very angry, and I said something again, you know, if you do this, I'll divorce you. And after that fight, I can remember the day, I can remember, I mean, not the date, but you know what, the setting. And he said, can you come in and I'd like to talk to you about something. And I really didn't want to talk to him about anything. And he said, no, this, I'm really serious. I would like it if you'd just come in to the living room and we'll talk. And I reluctantly or grudgingly or whatever, gruntingly probably, sat down and he said, you know, we've been using the word divorce with each other with some frequency. And he said, I would like you to make a deal with me and I'll make it with you that we will not use the word ever again. And he said, if we continue to use it, it might become a possibility. And we might speak it into being, and I don't want, will you make that deal? And that was probably one of the best deals we ever made with each other. It was his wisdom that brought that out. I would not have been that wise to have said that. But I have looked back on that many, many times and thought what a gift that was to our marriage, that he could recognize it and then bring it up and then for us to agree. And from that day forward, that word has never been spoken by either one of us.
Go ahead.
And again, I am not, this isn't like, you know, didn't we do that well? I don't know where all, you know, where that little moment of wisdom came. You know, and then the dating of each other was one night a week. We had a real live dangerous date. No one else was on that date. We got dressed up. We went out to dinner. It was not a movie. It was a romantic night. What?
It couldn't be a movie. We had to talk.
But we almost had to learn, because we were talking about bills and kids and life and work and I mean, not how you, you know, so we started doing things with each other romantically that we do if we ended up in a fair. If we had a girl, you know, if we had someone outside, we'd be going out to nice restaurants. We'd be doing that sort of thing. And the kids, in a way, I think the best gift you can give your kids is to love your spouse. I just think that they get that. I mean, it's a gift. Doesn't always work out that way. Not supposed to be a life sentence. Again, we were pretty well suited to each other, and we've had. And probably one of the most astounding things, my sponsor Warren was that, you know, Warren and Jen. When I came in AA, and, you know, 23 years old, it was mostly married. I mean, they were mostly 50, 60-year-old guys, Second World War vets that were married. I mean, it was unusual to have a single person around. So it was, you know, we had great modeling. When Warren got older, when my sponsor got in his 90s, the relationship was kind of like a father and son. I had a spiritual advisor who was kind of more active in that role in my life. And when we met Bob Marceline White back in 1974 in Hot Springs, Arkansas, I was talking at the old granddad, and I met them, and they came into our lives, and now Howard and Pat Poland. The people have good relationships, and there's something, and that was always on the table. I mean, you know, when you were talking about your life, when you were giving an AA talk, you were talking also about, you know, what the hell was going on at home. The measure of AA, today AA is so large, and some of the groups are so large, and some of the activity in the groups is so large that you could maybe measure what kind of an AA you are by how many meetings you go to, how many people you sponsor, and how well known you are, or how active you are. I was kind of taught that the measure of AA is the measure of your program. You know, what kind of a person are you? Is, you know, what kind of a worker, what kind of a spouse, what kind of a, you know, that what you do in your 12-step work is not the only, it's vitally important. You might not maintain your sobriety if you don't follow that. But you also, you're supposed to practice it everywhere. And I'll tell you, that's a tough standard. I mean, it is, you know, and so I was always lucky that the people who were the tall poles in my tent, you know, the Bob Whites and the Warren McGinleys and the different men and women that were in my life, they were committed to relationship. And it was, you know, so when you went and you had a conversation with them, the flashlight was, you know, on you. It was not on the story that you were giving them about her. It is. But I want to emphasize the fact that, I mean, do you understand how difficult it is to do something for a lifetime? I mean, it's really difficult. You are going to two or three times get to the edge of that cliff. And sometimes you're going to be all alone and depressed. Mm-hmm. And it's going to look like maybe if I just take one more step off the cliff, it's going to be relief. Drunks are not afraid to die. I mean, you say that, we all nod our heads. I mean, you say that in a church, people look at you like you're nuts. We're afraid to live. Yeah. I mean, half the time we think dying would be a relief from the internal dialogue that we carry into our life. I mean, how toxic can an internal dialogue get? How toxic can we be to each other? How toxic can we be to ourselves? You couldn't hire someone to have the conversation with us that we have with ourselves. I mean, it is just terrible. And I'll tell you, as you get older, you've got to develop some compassion for yourself. You cannot take the sword. You know, a lot of us were, you know, warriors. You can't live your life at the end of a sword, because eventually you're going to need to address certain things in your own life, and you can't bring a sword into it. You got to bring love into it, or you won't be able to go in there. You won't be able to look at it. You won't be able to be with it. And that's what is the separator. I mean, we all got crap that we, you know, don't want to look at. And it's just goofy. Can you imagine? You know, Linda at 7 years didn't want to do a fist step. Or at 15 years, you know, I mean, she hasn't robbed any banks. I mean, but it is, But that resistance to standing naked in front of ourselves is what the ego does not want to do. And the ego is not an amigo. I mean, it is. Okay, but you need it for the trip. It's a spacesuit. You can't take the trip without the ego. So we're not going to get rid of it. But when you get grounded in this program, when you start to get in touch with your true self rather than your false self, with not the ego identity, with your spiritual identity, your ego starts to be a junior partner. All of a sudden, when I'm irritated with Linda or one of the kids or whatever the hell it is, and all of a sudden I get this flashpoint and I'm going to bring out the knife and I'm going to go for it, and all of a sudden I get this, whoa, holy balls. I haven't had that thought in a year and a half. And there's a space between me and it. There never used to be a space. I used to get thought, reaction. I was like a monkey on a string. I didn't think there was any alternative. What you've given me is a choice. I get a thought, and there's this millisecond where I get a choice. Do I go with it, or do I not go with it? Do I add the story to it that I need? If I'm going to kill Clancy, you know, I got to add a story to it. You know, and I can do that in a millisecond. You know, but now I get a space. Don't always use it, but I use it more. My wife is a gentle soul. I used to talk about me not fighting fair. And I thought, what the hell is this fighting fair stuff? I mean, why? Those words don't belong in the same sentence, you know. But the culture she grew up in her family was a really gentle culture. I'm one of 7 kids. I mean, you've got to be a little bit loud just to say good morning, much less when you get in conflict, you know, to go do that. And what I had to learn over a period of time, I can't bring those tools to my wife. I just can't. I mean, I'm not going to end up either married or I'm going to hurt her, and I don't want to hurt her. And so it just altered, you know, but I'm able to see some of that. I didn't see that. I saw some of it in the first 7 years. And the first 7 years were not horrible. They were just not good, and they were getting intolerable over that period of time. We have, I don't know. Minnesota, 95% of the meetings when I came in Minnesota were closed-step discussion meetings. Mari gave the step 5 minutes. We break up into the 2 rooms and we finish the meeting talking about how the step operates in our life. I think 65% of the meetings in Minnesota today are closed-step discussion meetings. So we were schooled. Some people think that's too intellectual. Speaker meetings are the best. You know, everybody thinks what they have is, you know, special. That's how they got sober. But the fact is we were really exposed to that strong aspect of recovery. And when we had a conversation about the program, it was, what are you doing with it? And as a result of that, over a period of time, you get less places to hide. I was a guy who, if I didn't get caught, I wasn't really sure it happened. And that's almost so real to me that when I say I wasn't sure, I mean, I wasn't truly psychotic, but I was a neurotic in denial. Let's talk about, you know, my neurosis. But eventually you start to catch yourself. And when you start to catch yourself, there's no place to hide. And that's like a turning point. When you stop being able to BS yourself, when you've got the people in your life mostly trained to be straight with you, boy, you've got a lot of strength around you, and it's tougher and tougher to go upstream. You know, we can still do it. I still have moments where that doesn't happen. My wife, even though she's gentle, she's strong. And she will, that's what I was about to say now, she won't give any advice or opinion without being asked. which I just think is just the goddamnedest thing I've ever... I mean, why would you have to be asked? I mean, you know, I mean, why would you have the thought if God didn't want you to share it, you know? I mean, and if you had to be asked, I mean, you might wait quite a while. there are still a few things. And one of the hardest things about being in a relationship is when you're in the kind of relationship, primary relationships. So first of all, if your primary relationships are screwed up, it's really tough to have any other relationship in your life okay. Most of us think you can do that. It's really tough if to do that. But she has seen so much of me. She has seen the worst of me. She has seen the chicken shit part of me. She has seen the liar. But she doesn't have to hold, you know, when you're in those long-range relationships, our relationship is we mirror each other. So it's like living in front of a mirror. We don't always notice that. But if you're living in front of a mirror, you're being reflected. It is, I don't know, it's different than living in a home that no one can see into. It's like living in a room with no windows that the door is closed. It's like there's no place to hide. Now that responsibility, when you grant each other that, and she has the kind of kindness that she never brings up. There's about 15 things she could bring up that would...
Well, there's more than that.
More,
yeah. A lot more.
But half the crap you'd bring up, I could, it wouldn't bother me. But some of the stuff that she would bring up would really be hard for me just to hear. I mean, like she doesn't know. I mean, like, you know, what it is. So there's, again, this idea of gentleness. And I think that's what we do in the program. I think that's why we don't crosstalk. I think it's why we allow the sacredness, you know, that if I'm going to say something to Sheldon or say something to you, I'm going to grab you after the meeting. You know, I'm not going to do it in front of anybody, and I'm not going to do it to make myself look good. I'm going to respect your, you know, the integrity, the sacredness of your experience in that moment. So she has supplied. I was always kind of the discipliner in the family, and I overdid that. And I wasn't, you know, and when you talk about kids, my kids could have reached the conclusion, I don't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because my dad's a jerk. Gives a great AA talk, but he's an asshole. I mean, wouldn't that be a great epitaph to have on my tombstone? You know, it absolutely could have happened. And after those 7 years, I started going to a psychologist. I think being a parent takes 125% of... I think having kids is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. I mean, it just, the instruction manual is really slim. And I started going to psychologists, started getting some help with being a more... My dad was pretty physical with me, one of my heroes. You talk about recovery. My dad had 20 years of sobriety when he died. My brother's got 40 years of sobriety. From what I can tell, I'm sixth generation. My grandpa was a drunk. He was a carpenter. He was a hell of a guy. But, you know, so we have alcoholism up and down. And my dad, hero, maybe one of the finest men I ever knew, was very physical with me and was loud and scary. With fair regularity. I was the oldest boy, and I got the brunt of that. And I started turning into my old man, you know. And you never take the program out. The program's up, but all of a sudden you become a father. You take the cassette down, boot it into your computer, and boot up Dad. And all of a sudden your old man starts jumping out of your mouth without even, with no request, with no, you know, preparation for it. And over a period of time, you just think, well, that's the way it is. No, that's not the way it is. It's the way you're doing this, and it's not working. And until I started to get someone who took a look at it and said, you're too physical with the kids. If your brother Dick were their dad, he wouldn't be doing what you're doing. So where's the problem? You know, so now I got to go have that conversation. And but the other thing my father taught me, he didn't do it for himself, but he did it for me, is when men have a problem, go get some help. And, you know, that's what you've taught me in the program.
These are tough times. You know, when I feel like I'm opening my raincoat.
I thought you stopped doing that.
Okay. I have something I'm going to read, and Bob doesn't know I even have this, but I mean, he knows I have it.
Talking to the mic.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry, Lee. Jimmy. Bob wrote me. You know, you're self-deprecating many times about yourself, and I want to read you a letter that he wrote me. I'm not going to read the whole letter, but just to let you know, if you already don't know, what a great guy he is. Dearest Linda, I love you. I love you more than I did when we dated, more than I did. I'm also reading it, and it's very positive about me, and that's why I didn't know if I should read it. But as I'm sitting here, I decided to. More than I did when we married, less than I will as we go along. 30 years together. We truly are not one and not two. We've grown together in some healthy sense, but without trampling one another. I truly think we celebrate each other. To explain how much you have meant to me is impossible. You help provide a foundation and a stability from which I operate. You manage things so well as to leave me free to accomplish more than I ever could have dreamed to do alone. You share my faith, my God, my recovery, and my life. I bring you with me in all that I do. We are never alone. Your loving me has been one of the most important ingredients of my life. I have never doubted your love. You have a steadfastness and a fidelity that is like warm water washing over me. You are beautiful. You are sexy, pretty, delightful. I enjoy being with you more than anyone else in the world. I never tire of you. It is difficult to communicate to another how much they mean to you. I know I take you for granted in some ways, but know that that is not the reality. You are loved and appreciated. You made a home a beautiful place. You born and mothered our children in a way I will always be grateful for. You bring so many things to this process that I don't, and you make me complete. I think I'll stop it. It goes a little bit further, but that's how we feel about each other. And we don't always say it maybe the way we should, as most of us in this room don't always say anything perfectly. But I think the bottom line is to cherish each other. You cherish things that are dear to you, to take care of them. Even if it's a plant, you water a plant, or an animal, you feed it, you walk it, you groom it. In any relationship that's worthwhile, the more water and attention and nurturing you give to it, first of all, the more you know each other and the closer you are. And the second thing is, it's important for us to appreciate, but it's also important for us to feel appreciated. And, you know, we give tips to waitresses and waiters. Give each other tips. You know, you look nice, or I really appreciate you did that. I know that wasn't easy, but thank you for doing it. That's what I think that besides having a great foundation and having a God in our lives, and Bob's being sober, and my being in Al-Anon, I think you have to keep telling each other that you appreciate each other. You've got to keep the love, the nurturing, vital. And when you don't, I mean, we have periods where we don't. And I don't know about Bob, but I feel lonely when we're in one of those situations. And when we go back to having an intimacy, whether it be a conversation or whatever, it's sort of like, we're back. And it feels good again.
You want to finish this up? We've been given a gift of the program, which because of the illness that we have, we're required to put the principles into action in our program. I think the best description I can have after being around, you know, a pretty long time, is AA has gotten me to a point where I'm less interested in myself. I'm more done with me. I go out to give AA talks. I'm tired of hearing my AA talk. It doesn't interest me anymore. So I still do it, but it isn't. I don't know who that person was, 45 years ago. So I talk more about what's going on in my life today. But because the program, so I was at some thing, and I actually heard an Al-Anon say this. He said the steps are divided into four parts. The first three are to give up. 4 and 5 are to own up. 6, 7, 8, and 9 are to clean up, and 10, 11, and 12 are to grow up. And I thought the wisdom of that, the idea that it took me to doing 4 and 5, what Denny talked about, to really own my life, stop being a victim and stop BSing myself that someone else, is at the heart of this thing. And then to clean it up, which none of us, we were always going to start over, but we never started over before, after we cleaned it up. So we took the bowling balls out of the knapsack and we were able to then start the walk through the rest of our life with there is a space and an energy. This technology, the spiritual technology that are in the steps, the ability to be a worker, a sponsor, a spouse, a child, it is extraordinary because we're more cleaned out and less full of ourselves. And I'll tell you, that self-centeredness, God, it is just endless. It is just everywhere. I can understand why you wouldn't be self-centered, but I'm fascinating. It is just literally almost endless the time that I can get into it. But now I catch myself in that process. And the great joy of that is I watch some of my guys. I got one particular guy that Clancy knows well that's one of my best friends in AA. I won't mention his name because I'm going to say something slightly critical. And he was a hard ass. He Southside Chicago, grew up, he was a boxer, all that sort of stuff. And to watch what's happened, we met each other. We were both giving an AA talk at some place in Wisconsin. We were like two dogs circling each other in the parking lot. And I've watched what's happened to my friend in the last 30 years. His movement towards love. Hell, I watched it with Clancy. The last 15 years, he's a softer guy. It's a different. That's when you want to know which direction we're going, that better be the direction we're going. You should be able to measure, are you more loving? And I think with most of us, perfect? Oh, hell no. But are you more loving? And with almost everybody that I know that's doing the deal, I don't give a crap if you do it perfectly or if you do it my way, if you like. Are you doing the deal? Are you in the game? You got to help. Are you a player? No, are you a player? Anybody who's a player is moving towards love. And I'm grateful. As I say, Linda's been an unbelievably easy person to be related to. Not as true of our children. And our children are, I'll tell you, they're really good men. But the oldest can be kind of a pain in the ass. You are dealing with, money isn't everything, but it keeps you in touch with your children. It's life. And I look today at, the privilege of having those three guys in our lives, it's very cool. I wouldn't change it for a second. I wouldn't change who they are for a second. And there are times in my life where I thought I knew exactly what they should do. Peter, who was the most rambunctious, I always thought I knew what the hell he should do and how he should shape up. And, he was out living in L.A. He went to 5 colleges, never got the idea of attending until the third one. And he, so he's out in L.A., he gets stuck, decides to reinvent his life. Takes 20 practice exams for the GMAT, goes to England, gets an MBA at Oxford University, comes back to the World Economic Forum, make him a young global leader, and Harvard gave him a ride to the Kennedy School. Now, could I have? Why would they have that little jerk go through that process? It's beyond me. But could I have even envisioned that? I didn't see, I saw zero in that process. And that was because don't leave till your miracle happens? I mean, he was sober 8 years or no?
I don't know.
He was sober 10 years when that miracle happened. And
I don't have anything else. I feel like I'm just totally empty and extremely happy and grateful and really glad I got in touch with you about 50 years ago. It's just been a wonderful ride, and to be able to do this is a privilege. But we all have our privileges. We all are in relationships, and the more we cherish them, the better they're going to be. And Barbara, thank you for inviting us every year. You're just so sweet. We love it. And Dick, and all of you friends that come, that we get to see, and for the ones that are still, we don't know yet, I'm glad you're here. And I think I'm done, but thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. I'm done too, but I want to go back and emphasize the men and women that were our leaders and on whose shoulders we stand. I mean, we weren't just told what to do. We were shown what to do. And I don't know why I was given the gift to be as interested as I was in Alzheimer's. But I mean, and to think probably 10% of the people in this room don't even know who Chamberlain is. You know, when you think what you do is so gal-dang important, and you go to some place, you're at a meeting with 50 people in the room, and they don't know who Chamberlain is. I mean, how could you not know who Chuck Chamberlain is? It is not, so almost no one would know almost any of the people who made that difference in my life. Clancy would. I mean, that's one of the things we share if we've been around for a while. Thank you for my life. And one